Dozens of books, fiction, essays, and wonderful poetry, and I'm going to read one of his poems at the end of the class today. But rather than try to summarize all those books, I've identified what I think are some of the themes in his thinking, and I'm going through each of those. So last week I covered five of them. The first is that we should consider Barry as a modern Jeffersonian. He's trying to reclaim that agrarian image of grassroots democracy, small town community, and being close to the land, which was pretty much lost in this country during the Industrial Revolution and in the 20th century. And as has already been mentioned, he can also be affiliated with a group of writers called the Southern Agrarians. They came out with a manifesto in the 1930s. It was called I'll Take My Stand. And they criticized Northern capitalist industrialism for causing so much damage to the land and to heritage and culture. Barry is not exactly one of that group, but he has a similar point of view. So he's an agrarian criticizing industrial society. That's one way to understand his work. A second theme in his work is he draws the connection between culture and agriculture. He says that the way we eat determines how we use the land, and that has much influence on the kind of society, the kind of institutions that we'll have in general. So as a farmer, he has a lot to say about that, and his writings have been highly influential in the local food movement. A lot of the thinking that's been done over the last 20 years or so on transforming food systems, a lot of that comes from Barry's work. He was one of the first to really draw attention to this. A third way to think about his work is that he is an ecological thinker. He talks about the integrity of nature, the interconnectedness of all life, and humanity's place in nature, that we should not be dominating it. We should appreciate our part in nature and respect natural processes. Related to that is another theme that I call humility in recognition of ignorance. And this is where that reference to mystery comes in. He says that the life and the way the world works, the way the universe unfolds, it's really a huge mystery. We cannot understand it in all of its depth or detail. No matter how advanced our science becomes, no matter how rational our thinking, there will always be gaps in our knowledge, and therefore we should be modest in what we try to do with nature, because we just cannot know what the consequences will be. And then the fifth theme that I covered last week was his criticism of abstraction. He talks about using language very, very precisely, very carefully. We should say what we mean. We shouldn't use jargon or highly abstract or conceptual language to get in the way of our experience and our appreciation for what's really in front of us in the world and in other people. So an example of that is you take the term collateral damage, right? You can murder thousands of people in a war and then you excuse it. You say, oops, that was collateral damage. We didn't really mean that. So much of our political and economic life these days uses language in that way to obscure the damage that we're really doing to the world. And Barry wants to cut through that and have us speak plainly and say, well, here's what we're really doing. Here's what's going on. All right, so that's a quick summary. But
it's interesting that you're saying that because, you know, Ken Burns, Vietnam.
His early writing in the mid 60s and late 60s, and he was very critical of the Vietnam War, And I'll get more into that in a few minutes. But yeah, that was definitely a part of what he was thinking when he attacked abstraction. Okay, so let's go on to a new one that we didn't cover last week. And this theme I'm calling Community Membership and Fidelity to Place. And here's a quote from one of his writings. No individual life is an end in itself. One can live fully only by participating fully in the succession of generations in death as well as in life. So what does he mean by that?
Repeat.
We don't look at their work that much today anymore, but this critique of the rejection of culture and tradition that Barry is bringing forth here, that resonates with what they were saying. You had a comment.
I was just going to say that
is training young people to find the best jobs, which are always somewhere else. They're always in the cities. Or if they are in your region, as you say, they'll be transferred, or the whole company will move or send their jobs to overseas. So yeah, that's the kind of dislocation that Barry is criticizing.
Well,
Time titles is What Are People For? And that's what he's addressing there is if we're not allowed to find a calling, find work that's meaningful to us, and then do that in our lives, but we have to keep being transferred and retrained and replaced by machines, then what are we here for? That's his critique. Yeah, the bottom line. Here's a quote from our friend Bill McKibben, who, as you can imagine, is a colleague and friend of Wendell Berry. He says that Berry bears witness relentlessly to a value that most of our high consumer culture has actively disparaged, community. The idea that we are more than our individual selves. The idea that indeed we really only exist in relation to those around us, both human and otherwise. In essence, Barry holds up two worlds and asks us which is the nursery of real citizenship. On the one hand, the consumer paradise that we've built since World War II, now based on an endlessly spreading globalization, and on the other, a world in which local communities produce more of what they need and people pass up the lowest price to support their neighbors. So I think that's a good summary of what Barry does write about in many places. I think McKibben captures that. And here's another commentary on Barry by Reagan Sutterfield, who recently came out with an interpretive book about Barry. Sutterfield says, "Our lives are entangled and bound up with each other, people and land and other creatures, so that they can only find their flourishing when the whole flourishes together." So this is a critique of the atomistic individualism that's so much a part of industrial society and modern Western thinking. And it goes back to Descartes, right? I think, therefore I am. And it's very focused on the individual. Barry is challenging the whole Western philosophical and cultural tradition in having almost makes you think of Joanna Macy and the Buddhist understanding of we only exist because we interbeing, right? We're connected with everything.
Well, it keeps getting me back to that film.
Aspect of individualism versus communalism, so that modern economics is based on the rational economic actor, right? The economic man, with the masculine pronoun being very deliberate there. That because of the invisible hand, which somehow harmonizes all of our decisions, we can all act for our own self-interest, and somehow the market will make it all work out in the end. And shopping for the best price is really what drives us economically. That's just, we assume that. We assume that that's the smartest way to go. And Barry represents a tradition which questions that and says, no, we are not just economic beings. We have to look out for the whole and not just our own self-interest. And that's a radical rewriting of modern economics. But it's also it also represents a political tradition. And bear with me here. This takes a little bit of explanation. But when you look at the founding fathers, the founders of the American system, Madison and Jefferson and Washington and Hamilton and Adams, all those guys, they were not what we today would consider to be democratic thinkers. They were not modern liberals in the sense of emphasizing individual rights and individual competition for advantage. They held to a worldview which has been called classical republicanism. Now, it's not today's Republican Party, but Jefferson and Madison started a party that they called the Republicans, which eventually became the Democratic Party, so it's very confusing. But classical republicanism says there's a common good, that government can only work, society can only work, when you have a devotion to a common good that transcends your individual and party and class interests. And that the type of people who should be selected for public office should be those who have indeed transcended those interests and really are looking out for the common good. They didn't want political parties. Those came about not exactly accidentally, but they came about unexpectedly in the early years of the U.S. When the Constitution was written, they did not have political parties in mind, which was one of the reasons for the Electoral College and some other things, but that's a whole other... That's a whole other course there. I love that stuff, but that's not what we're talking about here. But anyway, the point is that Barry is more similar to that way of thinking than he is to what we think of as modern liberalism, which takes for granted that there are interest groups that are going to compete with each other, and that politics is very much about individuals and groups striving for their self-interest. So addressing this, Barry writes, community life places high value on neighborly love, marital fidelity, local loyalty, family life, respect for the old, and instruction of the young. Now, there's nothing wrong with any of these things. There's nothing, you know, inherently reactionary about them, but they're not the kinds of values that contemporary liberalism really emphasizes, and that's why the right wing today has kind of grabbed them and run with them. Barry is saying we need to reclaim those. And think of the good of the whole and not just individual freedom. He goes on to say that the collapse of families and communities leaves individuals subject to no requirements or restraints except those imposed by government. So to continue this line of thinking, if you're a classical Republican, or a paleo-conservative, we might say, you don't like it that government is the only institution that we have to answer to, that it's either the separate individual or the power of the government that confining the individual. If that's your only choice, then you're going to side with the individual. But classical republicanism says there should be intermediary institutions. There should be civil society. So the family, the neighborhood, you think of the lodges and the fraternal orders, everything from the Masons to the Elks to the Odd Fellows, all those kinds of things. Churches, other kinds of voluntary groups, maybe Baal counts as one. But that this is where culture shapes individuals. This is where individualism gets tempered by something bigger than oneself without the heavy hand of government, especially a distant government like the federal government. And Barry and others in this way of thinking really bemoan the loss of these kinds of institutions. There was a scholar at Harvard in the education program there, Donald Oliver, who he and his colleagues came out with a book. It was called The Primal, the Modern, and the Vital Center, where they compared this communal or tribal way of life with modern individualism and then said, well, what's missing is the vital center, these mediating institutions. And that. So local life is a way that we can reclaim that kind of community, that kind of culture that brings individuals together for a common good, a common purpose. So I've said a lot in a few minutes. What are your reactions to all of this? Here's a nice phrase I found at one point that captures a lot. He says, the task of community is to hold local memory and local soil in place. So just to summarize this point, what is this point? Community membership and fidelity to place. He argues that our place in the world, the local environment, both natural and social, shapes our identity. It shapes who we are and sustains our wholeness. The lure of money and self-advancement leads to estrangement from our roots, from our essential identity. Specialization, machinery, and abstraction, and money itself is an abstraction, compared to the native people trading objects, as you pointed out, but money allows for commodification. They prevent us from having a loving, caring relationship to our place. I think I mentioned this last week. Barry criticizes the expression "think globally, act locally." He says you can't think globally. That nationalism, patriotism, global thinking are abstractions. You only know the place you live in and the things, the people, the place you're interacting with on a regular basis. Get to that. Well, but if it's still a problem, we'll hash it out. But Barry wants us to reclaim our autonomy from the global system. That's really what he's about. To disengage from corporate endeavors and the market economy as much as we can. I mean, obviously we're plugged into it so deeply. Not everybody can run off and farm a little piece of land and be self-sufficient. But he's pointing to some ideal direction that maybe we could begin working toward that. All right. So the next section, the next theme in his work, the wisdom of culture and tradition. Community, tradition, the sense of place, they all have non-economic value. They have intrinsic value that contribute to our quality of life. But because our industrial society values money and wealth and market commodities for the market, we lose all of these precious things because we can't put a price on them. And then he makes the point that I talked about before about education. Here's a quote, to make a commodity of education is inevitably to make a kind of weapon of it, because when it is dissociated from the sense of obligation to a local culture and a place, it can be put directly at the service of greed. So why do we get educated? They take surveys of college students. Why are you in college? What's your goal to be in college? And in the 1960s, a large percentage of college students were saying, "I want to do good in the world. I want to be the best person I can be. I want to be well educated." And nowadays, I think it's something like 90% of students will say, "I want a higher paying job. That's why I want a college education." And Barry says that this is just cultural imperialism, really taking away something that's valuable. More thing to say about Barry in terms of culture and tradition. many of the commentators on his work consider him a religious thinker. I might have mentioned this last week. They consider him very firmly established in a Christian tradition. In what he actually writes, he uses some biblical language. He talks about moral restraint, and so you can make that case. But he is critical of conventional religious institutions. He says that the emphasis on the personal salvation is a mistake, because it takes us away from the natural world and our responsibility to other living beings, to the living earth. He thinks that in the Christian tradition there's not enough emphasis on that. And he's very explicit in a few places where he says, yes, I come from this tradition and I believe in much of it, but I have my lover's quarrel with the actual institutions of religion. So he's not proselytizing, he's not pushing any kind of sectarian or biblical way of thinking, but you can see how it, having that culture, having that intellectual tradition, it does permeate his work in many ways.
So we can forgive him.
Non-Christian, let's say you are a Buddhist, he still speaks to you, I think. But if you are a Christian, he also speaks to you, and that's some of these commentators that I'm referring to. They really embrace him from a Christian point of view. This Regan Sutterfield, who I mentioned, his book is called Wendell Berry and the Given Life, and he's talking about life is a gift, life is the creation by the divine, the mystery. We get back to that word mystery, right? It's all larger than we are, and there's a sense of awe and reverence toward that. And if you're coming from a Christian tradition, you can understand Barry in those terms. Okay. I'm just thinking if I want to say any more about that. I think the important point there is pretty much what I just said, that culture and tradition and community remind us that there's something larger than ourselves, that we're not just in this world as individuals striving for our own self-interest, and that it's fidelity to those larger realms of meaning that makes our own lives meaningful. That's what Barry is about. Were you stretching, or did you have your hand up?
No, just stretching.
Okay. Last week we didn't take any break, but I think we should take a few minutes. for a break. Oh, thank you. Maybe I'll go through a next theme that I want to cover is an important one, and that's how Barry redefines what we mean by economy. What is the economy? And here's a quote. He says, "The economy is no god to me, for I have had too close a look at its wheels. I have seen it at work in the strip mines and coal camps of Kentucky, and I know that it has no moral limits. It has emptied the countryside of the independent and the proud, and has crowded the cities with the dependent and the abject. It has always sacrificed the small to the large, the personal to the impersonal, and the good to the cheap." So that's what we call the economy. He wants it to be something different. In fact, one of his collections of essays is called Home Economics, and he says that economy comes from the Greek word for the home, the management of home. And if we think of the earth and our local place as home, then economy has very different meanings. He doesn't like consumerism, the way we define ourselves as people who make money so that we can go buy things that we need and support the economy that way. That turns us into passive clients of the industrial order. Then he says, "We must achieve the character and acquire the skills to live much poorer than we do. Virtually all of our consumption is extravagant, and virtually all of it consumes the world." So he's in the vein of the voluntary simplicity movement. Chris and I were talking about Jim Merkel a little earlier, if you know his work. Talks about really stripping down our material needs and living much more simply. Barry is all for that.
What was the rest of that verse? All our
using up.
Right.
Problem with the concept of job, of getting a job. If an economy that only provides jobs and does not enable people to follow their true vocations diminishes the health of the community. We were making that point earlier, talking about how people are forced to change their jobs throughout their lifetime. "Our present economy does not account for affection at all, which is to say that it does not account for value. It is simply a description of the career of money as it preys upon both nature and human society." Take that, capitalism.
Yeah.
I mean, that just says it all. I'll read that one again. "Our present economy does not account for affection at all, which is to say that it does not account for value. It is simply a description of the career of money as it preys upon both nature and human society." In another place, he writes, "It seems that we have been reduced almost to a state of absolute economics, in which people and all other creatures and things may be considered purely as economic units or integers of production. The pursuit of abstract wealth causes what he calls boundless dissatisfaction. We never have enough." Addiction, yeah. Some of the other writers we're going to look at actually talk about addiction. He doesn't use that language, but he's talking about the same thing. "The ruling ideas of our present national or international economy are competition, consumption, globalism, corporate profitability, mechanical efficiency, technological change, upward mobility. And in all of them, there is the implication of acceptable violence against the land and the people." Now, I think if you ask most people today, they would look at that list and say, what's wrong with those things? That's a successful economy at work. Barry is trying to pull the curtain back on the wizard there and saying, sure, all of these things work. All of them produce great amounts of goods and wealth, but they have to use a lot of violence to do that. There's a hidden or not so hidden cost to getting all those goodies. That's what he wants us to see. And then I love this phrase, which has been quoted in various other places. He says, a powerful class of itinerant professional vandals is now pillaging the country and laying it waste. A powerful class of itinerant professional vandals. Their vandalism is not called by that name because of its enormous profitability to some and the grandeur of its scale. So you know who he's referring to here, all of the corporate titans and certain political leaders who shall remain nameless. And
when did he write that?
He wrote that in, it's from his book, Home Economics, which came out, I'll get that. Home Economics, 1987. The guy's a prophet. He's been ahead of the curve on all of these things. It's from page 50 of Home Economics, in case you want to find it. A powerful class of itinerant professional vandals. The rural regions of the country have been and are being reduced by the great centralizing process that is our national economy. Most of the money made on the products of this place has gone to fill the pockets of people in distant cities who did not produce the products. So he often comes back to this argument that the global economy, the national industrial economy, is really an engine for sucking wealth out of rural places and concentrating it in the cities. That's what the economy is about. In order to deliver ourselves from our own destructiveness, we must quit using our technological capacity as the reference point and standard of our economic life. We will instead have to measure our economy by the health of the ecosystems and human communities where we do our work. So there is a movement today that's going in that direction, and they talk about the triple bottom line or multi-capital. There's a guy in one of my classes in Woodstock who actually wrote a book called The Multi-Capital Scorecard, trying to redefine capitalism to say that natural resources, human resources, community are just as important as financial capital, and that the bottom line has to include all of those. And one last quote on this topic of redefining the economy. Hovering over nearly everything I have written is the question of how a human economy might be conducted with reverence, and therefore with due respect and kindness toward everything that is involved. So in various places, Barry will use a term like the loving economy, or the great economy, and that's capital letters, the great economy. And he uses that phrase in contrast to the economy that we're familiar with. The great economy is the interconnected complex of all life. It's all of the things that give us our possibility of existence. The creation, that's the great economy. And if our human economy doesn't live respectfully within the great economy, it's not going to last much longer because we're utterly dependent upon it. All right, so I'm going to stop there. It's that I identify in Barry's work, and I should just say for the record that any reader of Barry could come up with their own list of what are the key themes. These aren't necessarily the single way to categorize his work, but for me, these are the things that stood out. So the next one I want to talk about is proper scale, which he often refers to as propriety. Propriety means controlling our actions to fit the context or circumstances. We recognize that what we do affects others, it affects the land around us. We should not be guided solely by what we want as individuals, but what is proper to the place or to the community. Importantly, propriety means we're selective about what technology we use. We need to be mindful of its impact on the environment and on the community. And here's a quote. Industrial technology tends to obscure or destroy the sense of appropriate scale and of propriety of application. The standard of performance tends to be set by the capacity of the technology rather than the individual nature of places and creatures. End of quote. So this is an argument against the view that technology is always neutral and it's how we use it that it really matters. Barry and other authors who we'll be looking at says that there's an inherent bias in any technology. As he puts it, the standard of performance tends to be set by the capacity of the technology. So you can think about that in relation to television or to cell phones or to leaf blowers or anything.
Industrial technology destroys.
Tends to obscure or destroy the sense of appropriate scale and of propriety of application. So Barry, like John Michael Greer and Derek Jensen and Vandana Shiva, others who we're going to be looking at, they argue that we shouldn't just adopt technology because it's new and improved and exciting and gives us all new powers and makes life easier. We should choose tools and technologies that are simple and appropriate to the task at hand and keep us connected with our context rather than dominating over them. So for Barry, this means farming with horses. He may have a tractor, he may use it for certain things, but in a lot of his writings he talks about farming the old-fashioned way. So the sense of scale then, so technology takes us into larger areas of impact, right? But he goes beyond that and says that all of our systems of production, management, governance, and education, all these systems are too large for human competence. Jason Peters, who's another commentator on Barry's work, says, citizens must act according to what they can know, not in the abstract, but in concrete particulars. So if you think of a bureaucrat in a distant government or a department of education or whatever, economic regulation, they have abstract rules. They have principles or procedures that they have to follow, which may have nothing at all to do with actual conditions in one place or another. But the rule has to be followed. The system has to grind on, regardless of its consequences to any particular place. So Barry says that systems need to be smaller. They need to be closer to local conditions. This is a political philosophy that's called decentralism. And we're seeing more and more interest in that. So today, this week, right, what are we seeing happening? Secession movements in Catalonia and Kurdistan, the Kurdish area, right?
Vermont.
I was getting to that. In part, there's some ethnic separatism involved, but part of it also is wanting to bring systems closer to where people are, and I think I'm seeing more references in the news now to the idea that the United States itself is too big, it's unmanageable, and that maybe it would be a good idea to break it up, and whatever form that is. Maybe California goes its own way, maybe New England, maybe the South. There are different ideas, but that was unthinkable until, well, maybe till January 20th, 2017. But really, it was unthinkable, and you're seeing more serious entertaining of that idea. One author in recent years who has promoted this way of thinking is a guy named Kirkpatrick Sale, S-A-L-E. And he came out with a book maybe 20 years ago called Human Scale. Chelsea Green, our neighbors in White River Junction, just came out with an updated edition of Human Scale. And in it, Kirkpatrick Sale is addressing the recent events and talking about how decentralism is more relevant than ever. So Wendell Berry is definitely in that tradition. Barry says we can only care for things that we love, that we have affection for. We cannot love things in the abstract. Here's where he gets to his critique of thinking globally. He says, quote, "The adjective planetary describes a problem in such a way that it cannot be solved. None of us can address planetary problems. A focus on large-scale issues distracts us from local and domestic problems that we can actually do something about." And then he says, "We must not work or think on a heroic scale. In our age of global industrialism, heroes too lightly risk the lives of people, places, and things they do not see. We must work on a scale proper to our limited ability." So here's that modesty, that humility, that recognition of our ignorance.
It goes back to the Vietnam series.
Okay, so that's proper scale. And then finally, there's a thread in all his work that we can simply call pacifism. He's very much of a pacifist. He's an opponent of war and violence in all its forms. So he says, "We must recognize that the standards of the industrial economy lead inevitably to war against humans, just as they lead inevitably to war against nature." So this is one reason, one other reason he doesn't like industrialism, because he believes it's inherently violent. And this is a quote, a long quote. "From the colonialism that began with long-distance navigation to the present stage of industrialism, we of the so-called West have lived and gathered wealth increasingly by violence. Violence is the norm of our economic life and our national security. The line that connects the bombing of a civilian population to the mountain removed by strip mining, to the gullied and poisoned field, to the clear-cut watershed, to the tortured prisoner, seems to run pretty straight. The purpose of this warfare has been to render the real goods of the world into various forms of abstract wealth, money, gold, shares, etc. The trouble with this is that it is bound to reduce the supply of real goods, the goods that sustain life, fertile soils, breathable air, drinkable water, and food.
Where did you get that quote? Can I
recommend? He expresses his pacifism by showing the effect of war on these families. So it's not, he brings it home, he makes it very intimate. And he says that war causes political, economic, and ecological decline on a big scale, but on a very intimate scale. It ruins families, it ruins communities, ruins individual lives. Any short-term gains from war, he says, are more than offset by the long-term costs. He was a vocal opponent, I said this before, he was a vocal opponent of the Vietnam War, and you'll see that in some of his writings. He said that it violated America's deepest values and also violated genuine Christian values. So there you see a little glimpse of that side of him, but he just thought it was completely immoral. And so the poem that I want to read to you was published in 1968, so right at the peak of the Vietnam War and at the peak of the Cold War, which is what it's addressing. So the title is "To a Siberian Woodsman," to a Siberian woodsman, and then in parentheses, after looking at some pictures in a magazine. It's kind of long. One, you lean at ease in your warm house at night after supper, listening to your daughter play the accordion. You smile with the pleasure of a man confident in his hands, resting after a day of long labor in the forest, the cry of the saw in your head, and the vision of coming home to rest. Your daughter's face is clear in the joy of hearing her own music. Her fingers live on the keys like people familiar with the land they were born in. You sit at the dinner table late into the night with your son, tying the bright flies that will lead you along the forest streams. Over you, as your hands work, is the dream of still pools. Over you is the dream of your silence while the east brightens, birds waking close by you in the trees. Two, I have thought of you stepping out of your doorway at dawn, your son in your tracks. You go in under the overarching green branches of the forest, whose ways, strange to me, are well known to you as the sound of your own voice or the silence that lies around you now that you have ceased to speak. And soon the voice of the stream rises ahead of you and you take the path beside it. I have thought of the sun breaking pale through the mists over you as you come to the pool where you will fish, and of the mist drifting over the water, and of the cast fly resting light on the face of the pool. Three, and I am here in Kentucky, in the place I have made myself in the world. I sit on my porch above the river that flows muddy and slow along the feet of the trees. I hear the voices of the wren and the yellow-throated warbler whose songs pass near the windows and over the roof. In my house, my daughter learns the womanhood of her mother. My son is at play, pretending to be the man he believes I am. I am the outbreathing of this ground. My words are its words as the wren's song is its song. Four. Who has invented our enmity? Who has prescribed us hatred of each other? Who has armed us against each other with the death of the world? Who has appointed me such anger that I should desire the burning of your house or the destruction of your children? Who has appointed such anger to you? Who has set loose the thought that we should oppose each other with the ruin of forests and rivers and the silence of the birds? Who has said to us that the voices of my land shall be strange to you and the voices of your land strange to me? Who has imagined that I would destroy myself in order to destroy you or that I could improve myself by destroying you? Who has imagined that your death could be negligible to me now that I have seen these pictures of your face? Who has imagined that I would not speak familiarly with you, or laugh with you, or visit in your house and go to work with you in the forest? And now one of the ideas of my place will be that you would gladly talk and visit and work with me. 5. I sit in the shade of the trees of the land I was born in. As they are native, I am native, and I hold to this place as carefully as they hold to it. I do not see the national flag flying from the staff of the sycamore, or any decree of the government written on the leaves of the walnut, nor has the elm bowed before any monuments or sworn the oath of allegiance. They have not declared to whom they stand in welcome. 6. In the thought of you, I imagine myself free of the weapons and the official hates that I have borne on my back like a hump. And in the thought of myself, I imagine you free of weapons and official hates, so that if we should meet, we would not go by each other looking at the ground like slaves sullen under their burdens, but would stand clear in the gaze of each other. 7. There is no government so worthy as your son who fishes with you in silence besides the forest pool. There is no national glory so comely as your daughter whose hands have learned a music and go their own way on the keys. There is no national glory so comely as my daughter who dances and sings and is the brightness of my house. There is no government so worthy as my son who laughs as he comes up the path from the river in the evening for joy. Wendell Berry.